You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Stage Left, a bi-monthly podcast where we talk about the latest shows on Broadway and beyond. I'm your host, Rob Russo, writer, theater critic, and founder of StageLeft.nyc, and co-host and co-producer of the Fabulous Invalid podcast, also on the Broadway Podcast Network. This podcast provides a platform for younger critics and theater journalists with the goal of broadening the cultural conversation to elevate and include as many diverse perspectives as possible.
I'm dying to know what's across the road, what's behind the wall, what's around the corner, and what will it take till I find my way? Will it be today? Will it be too late? Wait till you see what's next.
Joining me this week are Lewis Peitzman, a freelance culture writer with bylines in the New York Times, Vulture, Time, and BuzzFeed, in addition to his weekly newsletter, High Drama, which covers housewives, horror, and theater.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, delighted to have you here. You're what Helen Shaw would call a polymath, I believe, with those different
whatever Helen says is right.
That's good advice. And Jose Solis, freelance theater critic and writer with bylines in the New York Times, TDF Stages, Backstage, and the magazine America, which we learned is read by the Pope, in addition to co-hosting the podcast and web series Token Friends and serving on the nominating committee of the Drama Desk. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're delighted to have both of you this week to talk about three really great shows. We're still catching up with the fall season because not much has opened yet in the new year. So we're going to dive back in and talk about Tina, the Tina Turner musical, David Byrne's American Utopia, and The Inheritance. So three big shows that opened last fall. First show we're going to talk about is Tina, the Tina Turner musical. For those listening at home who don't know what that is, I think the title sort of tells you exactly what it is. It's pretty straightforward. It's a bio musical about Tina Turner. What did we think?
Oh, wow. You know, I went in really dubious because I feel like bio musicals are a trend that needs to probably go away or there needs to be fewer of them. But I mean, for me, it was worthwhile just for Adrian Warren.
Yes.
And I think that that's probably a popular opinion, that I could look past a lot of the issues I had with the book thanks to her performance.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, Jose.
I realized going into this that I didn't know much of Tina Turner's catalog, to be honest. Yeah, so I was sitting there and I was like, I don't think I've ever heard this song before, but wow, she's killing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because so many of these musicals are built on like the nostalgia, right, that the audience brings to the show. And for folks of our generation, I feel like we don't know as much about Tina Turner or her catalog unless we've sought it out or we've happened to come across it in the course of our own cultural education. Because her last big hurrah was sort of in the early 80s, right, with Private Dancer.
Right. I mean, so the show kind of ends well before now.
Right.
Which
is
interesting.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, Lewis, you touched on something that's exactly right. I saw it in London last year. And I was going sort of mostly to check the box because I was like, okay, like this is a big show. It's probably going to come to Broadway. I should see it in London. I'm here. But I had a sense of like weariness about these musicals on the heels of the Cher show and Summer, the Donna Summer musical, and Carole King. And there was even a Janis Joplin musical a couple years ago that I saw in D.C. before it came to Broadway. But I have to say, I actually really enjoyed this show because I thought the structure of it was very like direct, right? Like there was no sort of framing device mapped onto it. It was just her story. And it was, in a way, I kind of enjoyed that because the story itself is so compelling.
It is compelling. It's also not super different from all the other biomusical stories. I don't know that it's that. I mean, they kind of all follow a similar structure.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I've seen a similar story before. I don't know that with someone else in that role, I would have felt as compelled by it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because when I saw it in London, Adrian was out the night I went. And
oh, wow.
I saw Jenny Fitzpatrick. I don't know who Jenny is, but she was terrific. And she, you know, the show ends, I don't think this is much of a spoiler because it's all over social media, with this, you know, concert, right? Adrienne Warren becomes, I mean, she has been Tina Turner the whole time and she's been, you know, blowing our minds. But it's like the moment you've been waiting for, right? The whole show. It's been teased the whole way through and she just goes all out and you're finally like in a concert. I had that exact same experience when I saw it in London with Jenny. So, you know, I don't know if maybe if I saw them back to back, I'd be able to like pick apart what Adrienne does that makes her this incredible star. And she actually doesn't even do it 8 times a week, right?
Right.
On Broadway.
I don't think anyone could.
Yeah, right? I mean, seriously. If you haven't, you should Google the appearance that they did on The Late Show. She sings River Deep Mountain High and hits notes that I don't think any human has ever hit before on live television. It's pretty remarkable. But Adrienne Warren, right? I mean, she is the headline of the show.
Yeah, I kind of wish that the entire show had just been a concert. Her like reenacting a concert and talking about her life rather than like having all the extra characters.
That's what I wanted the Donna Summer musical to be.
Right.
Like, just give us the concert, especially Donna Summer. Because while I agree with you that like structurally it's not too different, Tina, from these other musicals, I do think that Tina Turner's story has more peaks and valleys than say Carole King or Donna Summer, which I felt like both of those shows were just all rise, and then Donna Summer just sort of disappeared.
Well, they glossed over the homophobia in Donna Summer's later life. So they could have had more of a valley there, but they decided to kind of, you know, move past that.
That's
quickly.
Real. No, there was that awful like mea culpa scene, right, where she like gave this apology from beyond the grave, and it was so awful.
I mean, who among us? But I. Yeah, no, I kind of felt the way Jose felt about, you know, being like, I don't really want to see just like a reenactment of a concert on Broadway. And at the same time, the book scenes in Tina were the weakest parts for me. And,
yes.
and the songs work best when they're just being performed as songs, when it's
right.
you know, diegetic. I just felt like that was what I wanted to see more of.
Yeah.
And so at the end, that's like, you know, the best part of the entire show is like the last 10 minutes.
Right.
So I just, you know, I wouldn't have minded just that.
Totally. I agree with that.
Yeah, although there's also something that I, you know, that struck me. And yeah, it's very similar to all the other biomusicals. But the book had something that I had never seen in a biomusical before. And it's that it kind of like teased about exploring Tina's spiritual life.
Mm.
And we had all those moments where it was hinted at. But it never, I'm assuming that they were like, no, you cannot have like religious stuff or spiritual stuff on Broadway. And maybe that kept them from like going all the way with it. But I was like, I wish we could see more about this. Because I love moments in which the book scenes like allude to her, you know, spirituality being connected to her relationship with other women and like the legacy of her grandma, for instance, and her mom. And then I ended up just imagining, because we really don't need the Ike scenes anymore. Like, I think we all know he was horrible to her.
Yeah.
And I mean, what's Love Got to Do With It does a very good job of showing us that. That movie's like great at that. So I kind of wonder what an old female Tina musical would have been like without all the Ike bullshit and like the white guy that she falls in love with at the end. She's like, oh, you changed my life and all that stuff. It's like, we don't need men.
They're
we
still
just
together
Tina.
Though.
Yeah.
They are still together. The German man that Tina Turner met when she was there. They're still together.
Wow.
I do think the spirituality was interesting and I thought the show opens with sort of the promise of that because she's chanting. And even though it is very traditional in a lot of ways, it has this kind of weird, surreal opening and then it loses that and goes straight into like, here's a straightforward biomusical, you know, telling of her life. I could have used more of that. I mean, I think that for shows like for biomusicals, I like when they kind of take chances in weird ways. I thought the Cher show worked for me because it sort of unpacked and subverted the expectations of what a biomusical is. And I think that, you know, for Tina, I would love to see more of that. I love that, like, you know, they just kind of do the Mad Max song and it's about her mom dying, which feels very, you know, not on point, but somehow works. It's just like, it's totally out there and wild. So more of that in biomusicals.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I loved the device in the Cher show of having the three Chers. I thought it was really smart. And I feel like a lot of folks sort of made fun of it, or maybe because it came on the heels of the Donna Summer musical where it was so poorly done there. Here, I to me, it really allowed for like a real psychological portrait of Cher to emerge that you wouldn't have gotten, that I did not get from the Donna Summer musical.
Well, they were literally in conversation with each other. So they were, they were, you know, and also we got things like
that.
We got like to avoid the creepiness of like, you know, adult Sunny hitting on teenage Cher by bringing in like slightly older Cher, and it's like that it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was very smartly done. I feel like a lot of that craft was not fully appreciated last season, but this season we have Tina. I'm interested to see what will happen to this form. Because based off the box office, I think we're going to keep seeing these types of shows. And what's interesting is that all three of the... Well, there's also Gloria Estefan on your feed. How can I forget? Right? All these women are alive. I'd be interested to see what will happen when someone makes a biomusical about a major, you know, musical act or artist who is no longer with us. And whether or not that critical distance will allow for a better show.
I don't know if you've heard, but Michael Jackson is having a musical very soon.
You know, I set myself up for that. Thank you. Yes. Well, I'm intrigued by that. I mean, there's a lot to be horrified by that musical, but I'm intrigued on that point to see what you're able to do when the artist himself is no longer alive. Because Tina Turner is a producer of the Tina Turner musical, right? Like, it's very clearly has her imprint on it, and I'm sure she was involved at every step of the process, and that might be why we didn't get to see more of the spiritual stuff that Katori Hall was maybe picking up on and wanted to, you know, push further on, but maybe Tina edited. I don't know. That's pure supposition. But
I mean, don't you feel like part of the problem, though, is that the people who are going to these shows are, like, diehard fans who don't want to see the kind of messiness of...
Right.
Donna Summer, I mean, is not alive, but you know...
Good point.
I think that the problem is people who are going do not want the dark side of things, the ugly side. The reason that the Cher show, I think, was allowed to kind of go into... like her infomercials is because Cher has a sense of humor about herself.
Yes.
And so
yes.
Even though she was heavily involved in the production, she was like, let's make fun of this. Let's make a joke about Sonny Bono dying. Let's like, you know, just have fun with it. And I think that that is a rare thing. And I want to believe that the Michael Jackson musical will really go there. I just don't entirely trust that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only way that could happen if we ever got like an unofficial musical, but that would never happen, right? It would have to be like a parody. They would never allow their catalog.
Well, there
to
was
be
apparently that musical. I don't know if it was a real musical, but in LA recently, that was like the story of Michael Jackson told from the perspective of his glove. Did you read about that?
Yes.
I read a blurb and was like, this is so weird. I just moved on.
The conceit of that show was actually really unsettling. So the less said about it, the better.
But I think
that's the way to go is just, parody.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, speaking of someone who is very much alive, David Byrne and American Utopia. That was a very jarring transition, but here we are. American Utopia is currently playing at the Hudson Theater on Broadway through February 16th. So if you are intrigued after our conversation, go grab a ticket. For those who don't know, American Utopia was the last album, studio album, that David Byrne produced in 2018. And this Broadway run of the show sort of culminates a world tour that he did that is the album, but also other songs from his catalog from back to his days with the Talking Heads. I absolutely loved every damn second of this show. I'm a like casual fan of the Talking Heads and David Byrne. I know who he is. You know, music was, you know, in my childhood. But oh my God, I was so blown away by this show. I don't know how you guys felt. There's a lot of nodding going on, but
I was very sick when I went to see it.
Oh no.
And I could swear that I saw the light at the end of the tunnel and everything. I was like, if David Byrne and his band are there waiting for me, this might not be such a bad thing.
Is it a show? Is it theater? Is it a concert? I don't know. And I kind of don't care because I just loved it so much. But I've never been in the theater where I've experienced music coming to life so vividly between the movement and the actual musicians on stage. And the whole show is staged by Annie B. Parson, who's a visionary choreographer. And the musicians are all free from any chords or entanglements or anything. They move about the stage almost like members of a marching band, but in choreographed movement from start to finish. And I was sitting in like row D, which if you can afford to, sit there, because I experienced the show free of the mix in the house. Like, the music was literally just coming off the stage to me unmixed, which was an incredible experience, because these musicians who he's handpicked, I think there's 11 of them, and they're from around the world, are extraordinary performers.
Yeah, I mean, I had the experience that Jose had at Tina, realizing that there's a lot of David Byrne Talking Heads music that I do
you
not
don't know. Yeah.
But I also really, really enjoyed it. And I thought that it kind of, I mean, I don't know if it's a concert or a show either.
Yeah.
But I would rather, if I'm going to see musicians kind of with these residencies on Broadway, which mm-hmm. is like a new trend,
right.
I want it to be a fully formed show the way that this was. Yes. I wanted to have that kind of choreography and not just be, with like no shade to Bruce Springsteen, someone, you know, sitting down and telling stories and playing songs, because like, that to me is not the best use of a Broadway theater, where we could mm-hmm. have, you know, full productions.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this was, like I said, capping a world tour, and they brought in Alex Timbers specifically for the last two engagements in Boston and in New York. And I wonder if he helped make it less of a concert, I'm doing air quotes right now, and more of a show, or if it always was. I don't know. I didn't see the earlier iterations. But you actually just brought up something which I made notes on that I wanted to talk about, and you're probably looking at my
I'm not peeping.
No, I wasn't saying you were cheating. No, but how do we feel about, you know, these types of acts or artists coming to Broadway and using Broadway theaters to do, you know, something that like what Bruce Springsteen did, or what David Byrne is doing with American Utopia?
I mean, I think there's a difference. I mean, there's definitely a distinction.
Yeah.
I just feel like, you know, there's a limited number of Broadway theaters.
41.
And there's, you know, there's so many, and there's some shows that are never going to close.
Phantom.
Chicago. So I'm very like nervous about how that space gets used.
Yeah.
And because we also have so many bio musicals, it's like, how many theaters do we need to devote to just hearing these songs people already know? I mean, is that really what we want to do? And obviously they bring in audiences mm-hmm. and make a ton of money. But yeah, I don't know how I feel about it. I do feel like with American Utopia, at least, like, I felt like I saw a show.
Yes.
So for me, I'm very comfortable with that show being there. And it is very life affirming and a bit of a spiritual experience.
Yeah, so. Totally. Now, I was walking on air when I walked out of that theater. Yeah. I was like, I wanted to dance.
Did it cure your sickness?
I mean, I felt much better, and I felt like I had died and gone to heaven. So that's not that bad. But also, like, it's something that it reminded me of a lot because of the form and how, you know, how challenging. I was like, was this a show or a concert or all right. that? It was like, it made me think a lot about An Inconvenient Truth, which, remember, it was just like a documentary, but mm-hmm. it was basically just like this guy just talking with a PowerPoint presentation. Right. I'm like, how is this? That's so basic and so, I don't know, simple, making, you know, having such an emotional impact mm-hmm. and effect on me. And I was sitting there just thinking the same. I was like, I want to think that I'm more cynical than to really let this wash over me and make me feel happy. But I mean, David Byrne won.
Yeah.
He also does give a warning about climate change. So yes. It's not totally dissimilar, and he's doing that. I mean, it makes me think of like what the Constitution means to me in terms of like, what, you know, how do we define a play? And that was very much a play, but it was also something that people hadn't seen a lot of, which is someone standing on a stage and talking to you for, you know, an hour and a half. And I think that I'm all for, you know, expanding the form and our definition of what theater is. I think that it just could also be easy to bring a bunch of major rock stars onto Broadway and just sell out theaters that way, which feels like maybe the wrong move.
Yeah, and I hope that's not what happens. I know they used the LaFontaine for a series of small engagements this past summer before Tina came in, which I guess is a clever way to make money when you know you have another engagement coming. But I would hate to see that become what happens long term.
Yeah, as a way to like kill time.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. You know, I can't fault
Regina
them for
Spector
trying to make money.
Regina Spector.
Yeah, yeah. And she's great. Yeah. Like that's fine. But yeah, as a long term plan, I'm not a fan. David Byrne is doing American Utopia in the theater, you know, very consciously versus someone who just like, you know, gets booked in this theater basically and is going to play a normal show on stage,
right.
Without much regard for like how, you know, people in the upper mezz might be experiencing mm-hmm. the show. You know, not every show works in those venues. So I think if the artists are considering it and really like trying to, you know, put on a real Broadway production, whatever that means, then like that seems like a different thing.
Yeah. But back to your point about Bruce Springsteen. I mean, not being a Bruce Springsteen fan, I know a couple of his songs. I went to that with my father. He was very nice. He bought me a ticket. We went together. It was his like second or third time. He was in heaven. He loved it. It was like the thing he took his best friends to. I sat there and I was so bored. I did not care what this man had to say. I didn't find him compelling. The songs were so stripped down. Whereas I feel like even if you don't know David Byrne's music, if you're not familiar with his oeuvre, you could walk into American Utopia blind and just completely be immersed in it and love it.
Totally. I mean, I think that I also feel resentment to Bruce Springsteen because they did that thing at the Tonys where he like talked and played. You know, remember that like long segment? And I was like, there are shows that I love that are not performing, and we are watching Bruce Springsteen because apparently we're going to trying to attract a certain demographic to watch the Tonys, which will never happen.
Right.
And we're wasting time. And so, yes, I felt bored by that. I did not see the Bruce Springsteen show because when my dad loves Bruce Springsteen, he would rather see actual Broadway shows, which I'm grateful for. So,
well, the tickets were outrageously expensive.
And they were saying,
I wouldn't have gone
so
if
expensive.
I had not been invited by my father.
They're not handing out comps to that one either.
No.
But I have a bias there toward Bruce Springsteen, even though I do enjoy some of his music and I'm sure he's perfectly lovely.
Absolutely.
That's not my kind of show.
Absolutely. Okay, well.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's move on to The Inheritance. For folks listening who are not aware, this play by Matthew Lopez is a modern adaptation of E.M. Forster's novel, Howard's End, that is set among a group of gay men living in present-day New York and grappling with the legacy of the AIDS crisis of the 1980s alongside contemporary questions of community and identity. It was a smash hit in London. It premiered at the Young Vic and then moved to the West End for a sold-out run there. Came to Broadway, where I think that the response has been decidedly mixed, if not hostile, towards this play. One of the biggest, I have egg on my face because we, for my other podcast, have had this invalid. We did a little spring, fall preview, and I was like, oh, this is the play everyone's going to be talking about. Like,
they are talking
about it. Well, sure, but maybe not in the way that the producers probably would have hoped. So let me lay my cards out on the table in case, Lewis and Jose, you don't know. But I actually really like this play. I understand completely the critiques of it, and I have enjoyed reading them, and I agree with much that has been said. And yet there's a part of me that just really enjoyed seeing it and that I don't want to like snuff out to be, you know, sort of with the Joneses. But I wanted you both on this show specifically to talk about this show, The Inheritance, because I think you both have really interesting perspectives to offer about it that fill a sort of a gap that perhaps I did not perceive in seeing the show. So I will open the floor to the both of you, whoever wants to go first.
I'll let Jose
to share
you don't
what
like
you
it
think.
Either?
No.
Oh, okay. I was like, oh God, are you going to gang up?
No.
Okay.
This is also a safe space, you know.
Ironically, in a way, I think that I also enjoyed it because it lends itself to be this like trashy soap opera.
Yes.
But that's what I wish it had been. If it had committed to that and if it had been just like, we're going to just be like queer as folk with less like sex. And you know, all of that, I would have been in, right? If it would have been, you know, like we're going to be like vapid and stuff. But instead, what bothers me so much about this show is that it also has that subtitle about like it being like a story about gay men today or something like that. And just by adding that, it's just like erasing like an entire, you know, amount of people, mostly people of color and people of different shapes also, and people who do not fit the stereotypical insta-gay, mm-hmm. you know, look, right? Because mm-hmm. like nothing made me want to, you know, like get on stage and kick the characters more than every time that the lead played by Kyle Soler was referred to as like plain looking right. or like unattractive.
Yeah, so and hideous. Like, I don't know how he does it.
Right, yeah,
he's
must be hard.
A freaking model. And in order for a play to convince, well, to convince me in this case, to follow it along with that, everything else has to be like pure camp and pure trash. But it wasn't, because then there were these moments when he was trying to do like the socially conscious thing.
Right.
Or moments when he was trying to talk about drugs and about addiction and about, you know, the perils of the entertainment world. And I don't even want to talk about the gay Republican in it, because like I'm just gonna like jump at this point.
I want to talk about the gay Republican.
Lewis will handle that. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean the play, you know, is about, you know, able-bodied cis white men. And there are some characters of color who are literally on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And the play has more interest in like showing the emotional interiority of a Trump supporter than it does of showing any of these, you know, characters of color and any sort of emotional interiority they might have. Instead, its moral seems to be that like rich, older, white Trump supporters are people too, which is a take. aside from those very obvious issues, I thought it was incredibly regressive. I thought it was sex negative, and I was surprised by how it seemed to delight in punishing character sexuality in a way that I thought was really sort of damaging and very 80s and very like, just that there are two big sex scenes in that show that are kind of portrayed as like these sort of hot orgy scenes that then turn into a character literally bleeding and. Mm. There's this kind of like this scare, this AIDS scare, and it's just like it feels very old fashioned and very damaging. And it's I don't think that like a gay play needs to tell everyone's story and be all things to all people. At the same time, like this is the play we're putting on Broadway, and this is getting the widest audience. So you have to ask like, why is this the story being told, and what is this trying to say about like gay men today? I think that having a brunch scene where you like shout out trans women of color is not actually doing anything but reminding people of what you're not showcasing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons why I wish we still had 110 opening night critics is because everyone has such different perspectives. And I loved reading your piece that you wrote about this, Lewis, because it illuminated an aspect of the show that I had not even given 2 seconds of thought to, right? Which is the way that the sex is depicted on stage. I have to say, my big takeaway from the play and what I like about the play and why I think I enjoyed it is I don't think that we see enough representation in media of intergenerational relationships among gay men. And that's something that has been very important to me and just sort of in my own, you know, life. And to see it reflected on stage, perhaps, you know, not as well as we might have wished, in and of itself to me was very gratifying and very moving and very poignant. Because there is a generation, you know, we're all in our 30s, 20 years plus older than us, who really lived through a time where their friends were dying left and right. And it doesn't really, I feel like it doesn't get talked about enough among our generation. I feel like if you're like, this play is almost like meant for us versus folks who are younger than us or older than us, because of that reminder that I don't know, just personally, just my own, you know, my own lived experience, I feel like we don't really talk about. I was very fortunate to meet and get to know at the end of his life, Dick Leisch, who was one of the earliest prominent LGBT activists in New York. He led the sit-in at Julius. You know, this is years before Stonewall. And just in the 2 years that I was around him and his friends, now they were much older, they were in their 70s and 80s, for me, it was such an education, the perspective that they were able to offer and, you know, the lessons that they were able to teach and just the model that they were able to give of how to live their lives. Because I've always felt that something that people don't think about enough is the fact that gay men, for the most part, or gay people, for the most part, are minorities in our own families, right? Like, unless you come from a family where your parents were also gay or, you know, your siblings, chances are you're the only one in your family. And that's distinct from, say, you know, being a racial minority, where in the world writ large, you might be a minority, but in your own family, at least, you know, you have that model and that support and that shared experience. So as a result, gay people make our own families, right? We forge our own community. And I appreciated what the play, the questions, at least, that I felt it was getting at around what it means in 20, I guess the play is taking place in 2016, 2018, what it means to be a gay man, specifically, and you would probably say a white gay man, in this world, and what our community is or isn't. I don't think the play offers really any answers, and maybe it doesn't do it as artfully as I think we probably, all three of us, would agree we would wish it had. But I at least appreciated that about it.
I totally hear you on that. Yeah. I think if it's that long, it should offer some answers, or at least like get closer.
It is.
Some.
That's right. I haven't said it. It's two parts, and it's a 6.5 hour running time.
I think that yes, the representation of the intergenerational sort of gay relationships are worth representing. I think that it's sort of troubling that in this play that what we get is this character who essentially is like, I have bad politics and I don't care about anyone else, but it's okay because I live through this generational trauma, which is very, very valid that he lived through that and we should have absolute compassion for it, but is really kind of a weird takeaway to be like, this is why I'm voting for Trump, which is not exactly what he's saying, but it's kind of what he's saying.
Yeah.
I think that while the play has a lot of like respect for that generation, it weirdly seems to have a little bit of a lack of care for people who are living with HIV now. There's a character who becomes HIV positive in the play, and I thought the way that that character was treated was sort of trauma porn. I mean, he's, you know, on the street eating peanut butter with his hand out of a jar. People are throwing things at him. It's really kind of perverse to me, and I think there was just like a real lack of care and compassion for people who are living with HIV now, who are not going to be these upper middle class white people that are being shown as the main characters, who are all aspiring to greater wealth.
Right.
So I also wonder, you know, like, would this play have worked, or would this person have written this play if the mentoring case wasn't like a hot daddy type like John Benjamin Hickey? Like, you know, like, because to be honest, there's a lot of ageism also in the queer community. And like, if you go to any of these bars that you speak of, you know, like in the West Village, you're never going to see like the young guys like going to the older men for advice and for history. That's something very romantic and something that I don't think really exists, to the point where I feel like The Inheritance is the play that Marco Rubio would have written if he was gay.
Wow.
I mean, also that relationship is sexualized in the play. You know, there is, you know, he has the one older friend who they have a purely sort of platonic relationship, but then once he dies, spoiler alert, then he ends up, you know, with his husband. Yeah. It's not really, I think that there's something really valuable in the model that you're talking about.
Yes.
And I do think that there are people like you who seek that out. I think that also like what we're seeing in The Inheritance is not that. And I think that it's great to see something where you can kind of bring your own experiences and project that onto the play and take something away from it because of that. And I think that's there's something really special about that. But in terms of like what's actually on the page and on stage, I don't see that.
Mm. Yeah,
I'm excited, however, to see how someone, a different writer, might grab something that I might consider my heritage. It's also like, you know, something British and extremely like upper class. It's not something that I would like consider my inheritance like at all. But I do would love to see, you know, people take on like Giovanni's Room, for instance, or James Baldwin, or like other great queer writers of color, and giving us plays inspired by them and creating like a larger inheritance than this just one monolith of whiteness.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the other part of this, just from in terms of like how the show is being received in New York, I think part of the issue is that it doesn't feel like a real New York play to me. It feels like, I think it probably worked better in the UK where it was not in New York. I think also the model of two plays, paying for two different plays, makes it very hard for people to see this. It's very expensive. It's a lot easier in London where plays are cheaper. Mm. So you have shows like, you know, Harry Potter and The Inheritance that come here and do not get the same level of success because, like, people just can't afford to go see, you know, if you're paying $200 a ticket, which is, you know, how much these tickets cost, you can't really be paying for that twice to see a show that got, I mean, here, mixed reviews at best.
Yeah. Well, I think that the economics of it are something that are really, really worth talking about because I agree 100%. You know, two-part plays generally do not have a good history on Broadway. I don't think any have really made any money other than this Harry Potter. And even Harry Potter is struggling. If you watch, you know, closely the box office numbers, the average ticket price for that show has plummeted. People are not paying full price to go see Harry Potter. And, it, you know, the other big example recently was Angels in America, which the producers of that show were very noble to bring it to Broadway and in the way that they did. But I don't think that show made a cent because people were not paying full price to go see two plays, you know, two separate shows as part of the experience of seeing the play. And I think that's what's happening here. You know, it's interesting that when they brought this, they do part one 5 times a week and they do part two 3 times a week. I think they have learned, you know, the producers have tried to learn the lesson of what happened with Angels in America, but your point still stands, which is that it is so expensive to see this play. And that in and of itself feels like, you know, in hand with so much of the criticism of it, right? Of it being about this class of well-off white gay men. And then, oh yeah, in order to see it, you've got to be very wealthy and you've got to shell out hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
Have your dad take you to Bruce Springsteen. Right. Have your daddy take you to The Inheritance.
Oh, I like that. That's good. That's very good.
I mean, the thing that troubles me about all of this is that I think that we take the wrong lessons from a lot of things like this. And I think that people might look at this and say, this like heralded like the gay play of the generation, which... Again, I would not use that terminology, but people were saying that about The Inheritance, comes to Broadway and can't really hit here.
Right.
Are we going to take a risk on other queer stories? Are we going to, you know, are we going to even bother? Because if The Inheritance can't do it, you know, what can? I think that is the wrong lesson, but I also worry that producers, you know, see the numbers and say, like, maybe I don't want to take a chance and maybe I don't want to tell a story, especially a story about someone who's not white, who's gender nonconforming, who's, you know, has a disability. I just worry that The Inheritance kind of like casts a shadow over what can then be done on Broadway in the future.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because oddly enough, rather perversely, going into the season, it felt like The Inheritance was almost like the safe hit. When, you know, substantively 20 years ago, you'd have been like, yeah, sure, the two-part play about a bunch of gay men is the safe hit, sure. Whereas The Bigger Gamble felt like Slave Play, which, you know, certainly is not what you think of when you think of as a traditional, you know, play on Broadway in terms of pushing boundaries with the substance of it. And, you know, Slave Play just closed, unfortunately, because the theater's booked, but, you know, did very good business and was, you know, the attendance was very high, if not the average ticket price. But, you know, it was the talk of the town this fall. I felt like I was sending all my friends to go see Slave Play. And one by one, everybody was blown away by it. Whereas, you know, I took some friends to see The Inheritance, but I don't know that I would feel as comfortable recommending it to everyone, even though I personally liked it. So... I don't know what that
maybe
means.
It's too long to recommend to people.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's a commitment.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, yeah, as you said, Slave Play did great business and did not do as big of numbers because the prices were deliberately kept down of tickets.
That too.
Yeah. To invite more people into the theater, which you know, was a very conscious choice they made that I think was a really good one because you want to be Slave Play is a show that everyone should see. Mm-hmm. And I think that a show like The Inheritance where you're you don't have really cheap tickets or you have very few cheap tickets and you have to see it, you know, twice, you're sending a message, you know, not consciously, but you're sending a message that this is not for everyone, that if you can't afford it, maybe it's not for you.
Right, yeah. I almost wish they had just produced part one this season and then waited to see what the reaction
I also
would
think
be.
That if I hadn't seen part two, I would have been less hostile about it as a whole.
Oh, interesting.
I think part two is when I really got angry, whereas part one I was like, this is sort of like... It's kind of fluff to me, but it's, you know, I get it. And part two is when I was like a little bit more distressed.
Well, something that we haven't touched on is that the structure of the play itself is sort of the telling of a novel that is being written while you're watching it. And so what it results in, and this is a critique that I 100% agree with, what it results in is an unfortunate amount of telling and not showing via narration for a good portion of the show. There's a lot of information that is shared in the form of a character standing on stage telling it to you instead of you actually witnessing characters in a drama, you know, acting out or living, you know, the scene that is being described. I almost wonder if The Inheritance would work better as a novel.
Well, I mean, it did when it was Howard.
Well, like, you know, exactly what I mean. Like a modern novelistic adaptation of Howard's End.
Because I was sitting there and I was also thinking, like, this writer is so unimaginative that every beat, it was following Howard's End beat by beat. And right. I love that book. So there were no moments for an 20-hour play to not have any moments of surprise was driving me insane. Because he was just following the exact same plot twists and turns and just changing the characters to gay men. And I was sitting there thinking, I probably would have read the book already in the time that I've spent, you know, sitting in this theater. And I also could have watched the Emma Thompson movie. Right. And, you know, what better gay icon than Emma Thompson to get through Howard's End, right?
I think that the problem with so much of that telling instead of showing is that you have these things that would, you're able to say like, oh, this character is ugly and no one likes him, or they don't really say that, but basically it's implied, or that he's like an amazing person who's going to change the world without actually telling you what that means at all.
Right.
And never showing it. And whatever he discovers about himself and his ability to like change everything is to me, I don't remember, maybe I forgot, but I feel like they never really arrived on what that was, except that we know that he is a great person. It's empty, and I think that the narration kind of tries to cover that up. Mm. I just, again, with it being 36 hours long, and we're just going to keep increasing the length.
Yeah, right, it's just going to get longer and longer.
Yeah, there's a lot of more you could show about who these people are.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Alrighty, well, we could go on, I think, probably for 20 or 36 hours talking about The Inheritance. clearly, we all have a lot to say and think about it. And a great way for people who are listening to this to continue the conversation or to at least continue following us is on social media. So I was wondering if each of you could share with folks listening to this where they can find your work and where they can find you on social media. Jose, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at Jose Solis Mayen, and I basically tweet every link to everything I write.
Perfect.
I'm at Lewis Peitzman on Twitter, and I also, you know, tweet to what I write. And my newsletter is lewispeitzman.substack.com, where I write about theater, among other things. Horror and housewives.
Yeah. Awesome. Great. Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Just around the corner, a new bit of history there, right? Something you all might underestimate.
That's it for this week. Stage Left, the podcast, is a co-production of The Fabulous Invalid LLC and O&M Etc., and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was edited and engineered by Jamie Dumont and Charles Van Kirk. And special thanks to Jason Robert Brown for our theme song, Wait Till You See What's Next, from his spectacular album, How We React and How We Recover. You can find this podcast online at stageleft.nyc, on the Broadway Podcast Network website, on iTunes, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can read my archive of reviews at stageleft.nyc and find me on Twitter at stageleft_NYC. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll tune in next time.
Wait till you see what's next.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It's time to take your body care routine to the next level. Introducing Osea's bestseller body care set, the perfect companion for your summer travels. This four-piece kit transforms dry skin to silky, soft, and glowing. It features travel sizes of Osea's best-selling Undaria Algae Body Oil and Body Butter, clinically proven to improve skin elasticity, along with their anti-aging body balm and Salts of the Earth body scrub. And to top it off, it's packed in a vegan leather bag, making it a must-have for all your summer adventures. Everything Osea makes is clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Treat yourself to glowing, healthy skin this summer with clean, vegan skincare and body care from Osea. Right now, you can get the Best Sellers body care set valued at $78 for 33% off. Use code SUMMER to save an additional 10%. That's an additional 10% off at oceamalibu.com, code SUMMER.